Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. So what happens when an iconic rock star with everything to prove finds a runaway teenager stowed away on his tour bus? The synesthetic teen sees music in colors. Can she help the colorblind rock legend overcome his creative block and write the songs he was already supposed to have written? We'll find out more in just a moment. We're talking today with Andrea Faisenfeld. She's an award-winning TV producer who decided to channel her storytelling skills into fiction. A Rainbow Like You is her second novel and was inspired by years of following her favorite bands to some of the world's most iconic musical venues. Here's my guest, Andrea Faisenfeld, her book, A Rainbow Like You. Andrea Faisenfeld, welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, my pleasure. It's always good to read somebody who has a slightly different story, and this is a different story. We're talking today about your new book, A Rainbow Like You. But before we dive into that, I want to just share a little background of yours with our listeners, since we haven't talked before. You're a TV producer and writer. So tell us a little bit about how that started for you. Did you choose that field, or did it choose you?
I actually spent 7 years in finance and then was studying for my CPF, Certified Financial Planner. And then I realized that I really didn't want to spend the rest of my life in finance. And through luck of a draw at a friend's wedding, I ended up speaking with someone who worked in TV commercial production. And she was working with a lady from Los Angeles who was looking to partner with someone here in Vancouver. And we ended up hitting it off over the phone. And we're still friends to this day, but I kind of got into the commercial production industry that way and has never looked back.
Great. And so tell us, what kind of projects do you typically work on then?
Well, in the TV commercials, almost 99% of all my clients are American. So we deal with every sort of major Fortune 500 company that there is, you know, from Ford to McDonald's to Intel to Honda. So we do a lot of TV commercials, and I've also worked with most of the major networks dealing with docudrama series, television movies.
Very cool. So as writers, life is often inspiration for our stories. And your first novel was inspired by a week you spent with Hare Krishnas in Hawaii, I heard. So what was that experience like for you? You're quite young, right? You were kind of winging it, if you will.
Yeah, my friend and I did what teenagers do, and we lied to our parents. We both had fathers that worked for the airline, so we could fly to Hawaii for cheap on family passes. But then, of course, had no place to stay. And we ended up getting picked up on the beach by the Hare Krishnas, who offered us a place to stay, and we said, well, why not? So, yeah, it was very interesting. And just chatting with all of the people that were in that group, just trying to understand how they got there, and I just sort of felt a lot of sort of sadness and kind of hope and longing for something that they weren't necessarily finding. But it's sort of, once you cross that threshold into that environment, you're in the real world, but you're not in the real world anymore. And I kind of like that dichotomy.
Yeah, and so how did that inspire the story for your first novel?
Well, it was very much about, okay, well, what happened then if someone came into some sort of far more mysterious sort of cult compound, didn't know what was going on there, and this person was actually running from the law for a variety of reasons. So I just kind of like that as a way to ratchet the tension, where this person has something to hide, and then they land on this cult compound and they get sort of caught between these two feuding members who also have sort of murky motives. So it was just a real interesting way to build the story, because you have someone coming into the situation blind, and then slowly the onion layers get peeled away in terms of what their story is, what's really going on this compound, etc.
Mm-hmm. And was it inevitable to you that at some point you'd become a novelist? I heard you say or write that you were destined to write your second book because it's actually based on a touring rock band.
Yeah, you know, I was told that from a very young age that I should always be a writer, and it's nothing that I really pursued, and I don't know why I didn't, but it was always, I've always kept journals, always expressed myself really well with the written word. And ironically, it was going through a Toastmasters program in 2015, which is a public speaking program, the global public speaking program. Mm-hmm. And through there, you know, you have to craft all these different speeches that you do. And I was realizing that the speeches that I wanted to tell, they weren't sort of business-oriented or, you know, trying to get points across. It was like, how do I weave a story and sort of captivate an audience? And that really sort of spurred me to just plop my butt down and start writing my novels.
Hmm. And so the book we're talking about today, your second novel, A Rainbow Like You, was voted Best BC Book, British Columbia Book of 2020, which you must have been quite thrilled about, I'm sure. And you say you were destined to write that because it's based on the touring rock band. And I heard you say on your website, I think, that you've been to over 400 shows.
Yeah, and a lot of them in the Seattle area, actually.
Of course.
Yeah, and it's interesting because from the get-go, I've always saved my ticket stubs. So I have this massive collection. And I'm very disappointed these days because a lot of times you don't get the cool tickets anymore. They're just these online pieces of paper. So it takes all the fun out of the collection.
Right, right. And so the book is described as a modern-day redemptive tale. So let's begin with a synopsis of the story so listeners know what we're talking about. It begins with rock and roll legend Adrian Johnson. He's taken a year off to recuperate from burnout and all that goes with that, including creative block. Now he's back on tour with his band. He just started, so take it from there if you would.
Yeah, so he's at this crossroads, you know, personally and professionally with all the stuff that's kind of compiled over the last little while. And, you know, he's sort of questioning everything still. And but because he's the main creative force of the band, he's the guy that always writes the songs, and he's sort of under pressure now to make his next hit. And then he finds this teen runaway hiding on his tour bus. And as it turns out, this young lady has synesthesia, which is the ability to see music in color. And when it's revealed that he's colorblind, you know, she offers that maybe she can help him unpack his creative block. And that, of course, takes him on this very unexpected journey.
Yeah, I mean, who wouldn't like a muse like that locked, you know, stowed away in the cupboard somewhere that they could pull out when they need it? So her name is Hastings. She's a teenager, as you said. But I'm wondering, what came first when you're thinking of the story? Was it the character Hastings, or was it, you know, let's have somebody, let's build a character that has synesthesia?
Well, the voice of Adrian is actually what came first, and I kind of muddled my way through, you know, who's he, what's he all about? And I just had this distinct vision of him in this tour bus, very sort of lonely and isolated. And for reasons I can't really clarify, for some reason I just knew he was colorblind. And I've always been sort of fascinated with synesthesia because it's this real sort of condition that even the medical community doesn't know how it transpires in humans. They don't really understand it. So as a writer, that's always really interesting to me because then it gives me a wide berth to create from because I'm not kind of hemmed in with a lot of rules and regulations.
Yeah, I actually did a show with a medical doctor who's synesthetic. He sees words and numbers in color. I think that's gamophone or something like that. There's over 70 different types of synesthesia, right? And it's so, yeah, I can see that would give you a great wide open gateway there to craft a character that you know, to suit your story. So tell us how you developed the character of Hastings, because she's quite a complex little being.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, of all the characters in the story, when I first started writing it, she was the one that I didn't have the clearest sense of what her sort of racial or ethnic background was. Everybody else I was pretty locked and loaded when I started. And her character in particular was a bit, not a challenge, but I had to think about it a lot because there's parts of her that need to get revealed at certain times. Mm-hmm. Is really crucial to the tempo of the story as to when those elements got rolled out. And I was also cognizant of the fact that, you know, first of all, there's the age difference between her and Adrian. She's female, he's male. So I had to make sure that it didn't come across as creepy, so I had to nip that in the bud right away. But I also didn't want to create one of these sort of precocious, know-it-all types of teenagers that, you know, Hollywood often portrays. You know, I wanted
right,
a girl
right.
with more depth, someone who is actually just quite perceptive, but then aligns herself with Adrian because they are sort of going through similar things. You know, they're both sort of lonely. They're both loners, and they're both struggling at the time that they meet.
And I think another interesting thing from a writer's perspective is that you wrote the story. Your protagonist is Adrian Johnson, the rocker. He's about 30-ish, correct, if I remember?
That's right.
Yeah. And you wrote this in the first person, so you're writing from a male protagonist's point of view. What made you to choose to write from the perspective of a man?
You know, as a writer, I just have to honor the voice that comes to me, and I don't differentiate or feel like it's any different whether it's a male or a female. And it's interesting because I get that question a lot, but it's quite common, you know, particularly in the romance genre. A lot of books are written or flip back and forth between a female and female point of view.
Yeah.
So it's not quite so surprising to me, and it actually feels very natural.
Hmm. Well, yeah, that tells. I mean, it flows very well. I think it was Andrew Gross that I interviewed and when he'd done this start of a new series, and he'd written it, he'd written his protagonist as a man. So he goes back to his agents and his editors with his manuscript, and they're like, "We love it. However, we think your protagonist should be a woman." So he had to go back and change it all from a male perspective to a woman's perspective, which I'm guessing was quite a job to do, really.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that story, because when I was at San Francisco at a writer's conference a couple years ago, I was sort of soft-pitching the story as I was developing it, and I was at a cocktail party and just speaking with an agent, and I gave her the sort of the logline synopsis, and up until that point, I had great feedback from, you know, fellow writers and just strangers that I was telling the story to, and she gave me this really funny look, and she said, "Why did you write the story from a man's perspective?" But her take on it was more of that I had sort of betrayed the sisterhood, that I was a woman and had the chance to write the story from a female perspective, but then I went with a man. So I just realized I was sort of dead to her at that moment and moved on.
Huh. That is interesting because, you know, we're in a time right now, I don't have to tell you, where everybody's questioning everything. You know, actors are being kind of bullied out of roles because they're, you know, I'm thinking Scarlett Johansson dropped a role because she wasn't transgender. There's another famous writer I spoke with, and I just can't recall the name right now, but similar kind of thing where they were told, well, you can't write about that because you haven't had that experience. But to me, the whole thing about art is our interpretation, you know, and there's research as well. How do you see that?
My point of view is this, is I don't want to be handcuffed into writing any one particular role or story, and I feel it's a big disservice if all I feel like I can write is like a white female story, because in a way, isn't that just sort of perpetuating the fact that there's no diversity or lack of diversity in storytelling? So again, you know, going back to my earlier point, you know, you have to sort of honor the voice that comes to you, and you can't kind of second guess yourself and think, oh, well, this is actually what the market wants me to write, or this is what the, you know, the PC crowd or the social justice warriors want me to write about. And not that I'm insensitive to these things and these
right.
issues, but I agree with you wholeheartedly. You know, art cannot, it has to be something like the whole arena of comedy, where for once we can just kind of let ourselves go and not be sort of led by all these constraints.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is, we're dealing with fiction here. It's about escapism. I mean, if we want hardcore realism, there are plenty of nonfiction books out there, you know. So I'm all for giving people the opportunity to do what they want to do. So let's talk about Adrian Johnson a little. Did you base that character? He has a lot going on in his life, you know, ex-wife, all these thoughts in his head about where he should be and what he should be doing, etc. But did you base that on anybody in particular, a compilation, or did he just come to you through writing?
No, he just came to me through writing. I was, when I was doing the first pass of the story, his personality was slightly different. He had was a little more cocky, but as I was working through it, I realized that really wasn't who he was. And later on, I attributed some of the lines and attitude to sort of the antagonist of the story, which is the bass player, Norman Hunger. But he, and then I really found Adern's complexity, his wings, as I was working through like the second and subsequent drafts. And yeah, he's probably one of my most complex creations.
Mm-hmm.
But I just like the fact that he was really raw and sort of unapologetic for who he is, but also understands who he is, his pros and his cons.
Yeah. And also very open, because, you know, if somebody is hiding away in your trailer and then they suddenly say, hey, I can help you overcome your creative block because I'm synesthetic, you know, he had to be open to that, too. I read that you have a love affair with dialogue, which being a TV producer and writer makes perfect sense. But how do you approach your dialogue when you're writing it in a novel?
Well, in terms of like a fundamental approach, a lot of times I will write dialogue passages in a notebook first. And I do that in terms of just sort of more stream of consciousness, sort of freestyling without feeling like I have to hit every beat or every nuance. Sometimes you feel that way when you're banging it out on the computer. And a lot of times I walk around at night. I'm not, you know, crazy neighborhood lady that talks to herself in the dark. And I kind of speak out the different things, how it's going. I don't know why I like that. It's kind of like the night is quiet and I just don't feel like my mind's racing.
Uh-huh.
And stuff just comes to me that way. And I feel like that's sort of like the two-way that I approach dialogue writing that works.
Yeah, I actually am the same way about, my favorite time to write is at night, you know, the witching hour. And like you said, it's quiet, it's dark, there's not a lot of distraction going on. When you look back at how you wrote your first novel, what did you learn there that you took with you into the second novel, if anything? Because they're quite different novels, I know that, but as a writer of novels, what did you learn from the first one that you took into the second one?
Structure-wise, you know, how completion rolled out was very different in that with the protagonist, because of how the tension ratchets and things are slowly revealed. What I learned just from hearing different feedback from reviewers, etc., is that sometimes works and it sometimes doesn't. That sometimes people want to kind of get into the corner of your protagonist and understand them and align yourselves with them. And, you know, you do that in different ways as a writer, you know, by sometimes indicating what their moral code is, you know, just something so that down the road when they start making a bunch of cornball decisions and you want to strangle them, you have some basis for understanding, knowing that they're a good person or that fundamentally they're thinking X or Y. They're just kind of on this wild goose chase. So that's something that I did a little bit more of, a more traditional structure in A Rainbow Like You.
Mm-hmm. And what about scenes, writing scenes? Is there a particular type of scene that's harder for you to write than others? Are there particular scenes that you really enjoy writing?
I actually really enjoy writing romantic scenes, like sort of feistier scenes where, there's people are kind of getting it on.
Okay.
I don't know. And I've had comments off my books from people, men especially, who kind of enjoy that. And it was interesting in A Rainbow Like You because it's coming from a man's perspective. A couple of sort of hotter temperature scenes, and I think it's just interesting because in a lot of stories, you know, in romance novels, people expect that, but I don't think people sort of necessarily expect that in a regular novel.
Mm. And so, what's been the reaction of your friends when you've read that? I know, as I've read friends' books, and I'm like, okay, I really don't want to know that. It's like. It's kind of different. It's one thing, you know, reading it from a novelist you don't know or, you know, you're just familiar with their work. But when you know somebody very well, it's a different kind of feeling when you're reading those scenes.
Well, you know, most of my friends, you know, they know me well, so I don't think they're surprised in the slightest.
Okay.
Like, oh, yeah, there's Andrea.
There you go.
And Andrea.
So what's the best part of writing to you and what's the worst part of writing?
The best part of writing is, actually one of my favorite parts is the editing process. The last two books I've used two different editors and I don't do a developmental edit, I do line edits and proofreads. But I enjoy that part the most because I can kind of let the project go, I know it's at a certain point, And then when it comes back, I find it's like, oh, this is it. This is like the home stretch. Hmm. Very satisfying.
Yeah, that's the first time I've heard the editing process is a favorite part. Good for you. So, and I can see that because you're pulling it together. You're really structuring it there. So how do you know when your book is finished? What does that just feel organic to you? I've talked with many, you know, thousands of writers now, but some say they can never get to, they have to have somebody else, their editor or agent, say, okay, this is done here.
No, I don't have that problem. It's just, I have a very strong sense of the story when I start. I don't necessarily commit to one ending. Like, I always write a few chapters with the characters first, again, just to get under their skin, because once they start interacting, they tell me things about themselves that I didn't know already. And then, you know, then I start sort of structuring it as I understand themselves as characters more and what they're going through. And then ultimately there is an ending that becomes obvious, and when I finish it, I kind of know when it is.
Right.
The same thing before I go into editing. The reason why I don't do developmental editing is I am pretty fastidious with making sure my story's at a certain place, and I really just need the sort of finesse of a line editor at that point.
Right. So what's your key takeaway from this book? What did you learn during this process that you're going to take away with you for next time?
I learned just how great it is to be a writer.
Ah, there you go.
Feedback's been phenomenal. And, you know, I don't write because I'm necessarily seeking fame or fortune, but obviously any creative person, it's great when you have your material resonate with people. And this one really has. And the ability that I had to also become a songwriter with this story, because I wrote an original song that's a companion piece, that was just, as a music fan and a music lover, to be able to contribute to the musical universe was just the cherry on top.
Mm-hmm. Is that the first time you've written a song?
Yeah, it was. It's probably the first one. It's probably the only one. I mean, I love the songwriting process, but it's people spend their careers doing that, and it's, you know, I can't be that dilutive. I can't spend the time and the energy on that, because you really do need to put your full energy into it.
Yeah, I think today, especially with the technology that we have, there's a temptation for others to expect this, and also to try and put this expectation on ourselves sometimes that we can do everything. And we do have to, I think, narrow down and focus on what we're really, really, really good at.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, especially that we live in an ADD society right now, mm-hmm. you know, where people can barely get through a single article on their phone without being distracted.
Right, that's so true.
And as a writer, you know, part of, you know, if you had a dollar for every person who said they want to write a book, you'd be like a bazillionaire. But there's a doggedness that comes with it. And if you don't have it in your heart and you're not fully committed, you know, at some point you're just like, ugh, I can't be bothered with this anymore. But, you know, to me, that's the joy of a writer, is that you just kind of go through these painful bits because you just know the story has to be told, and damn it, you're going to tell it.
Yeah, I remember going when I was at documentary film school up here in Washington, and our executive producer said, you'd better love what you are going to film and write about, because you're going to hate it by the end, if not. It's very true in whatever you do. So let's talk a little bit about COVID and how that's impacted you, if at all. I've talked with a lot of people who are really avid readers, and they say, well, I keep reading the same chapter over and over. I can't seem to move forward. I've talked with writers who've had the same issues. Have you found that at all or not?
It's stymieing my creativity, or just...
Yeah.
No, not at all. I'm actually, you know, I mentioned romance a little bit because I'm writing romance under a different persona, which I'll be launching later this year. And I've got the third book under my brand, Andrea Faisenfeld, on the go. And I'm just in the process of finishing up another television pilot. So okay. I've actually embraced COVID.
Good. And so how do you go about marketing your work, especially during these times? Because, you know, you can't go to a bookstore and meet people. But there are plenty of technical, digital ways of doing this. But what's worked for you really well?
Well, you know, finally you asked that question. I mean, because in this day and age, you know, everyone is, you know, social media and technology, et cetera, which I think works to an extent. But I find that the tag team efforts of what I've done digitally and all the back end stuff that, you know, 21st century authors need to know about And then pairing that with sort of traditional publicity, which you know, I hired a publicist for this book, that's been actually the special sauce in how this book has sort of gained some momentum, because people still do look at traditional media. They respect it. It's a form of social credibility. So if you can team that with, you know, great online presence and knowing how to kind of find channels to market your book outside of, you know, brick-and-mortar stores, then it's kind of gold as an author.
Right, right. Well, Andrea Faisenfeld, it's been a pleasure talking with you. The book is called A Rainbow Like You, and I know listeners can find out much more about you and your work at andreafaisenfeld.com. What do you want to leave our listeners with today, Andrea?
Well, you are in the Seattle area, so I will give a nod to that whole community there, because Seattle and the surrounds does play a part in the story. And my main musician, Adrian, is a huge Hendrix fan, and of course, Seattle is the hometown of Hendrix.
Yes, you mentioned his grave in Renton, Washington, yeah. And I'd forgotten that until I read that. So thanks for being with us. We really appreciate your time, Andrea Faisenfeld. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Vicky.
All right. Feedback, questions, or comments on today's show, you can find me at conversationslive.net. Until next week, stay healthy and be safe out there.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.